I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, we've been told that beauty is only skin deep, but actually there is a pageant of beauty going on below the skin. Unfortunately, we've been conditioned not to contextualize the working of the human body in the terms of wonder and awe. Instead, we've been issued blinders to view the bones, tissues, and organs in the cold light of science as virtual mechanical objects. And in that scientific view, there is the omniscient of view in our bodies as incredible vessels of a rich but brief existence. In the new book by Dr. Gabriel Weston, Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence, we are taken on a profound exploration of human anatomy that transcends the traditional medical perspectives by integrating science, history, philosophy, and art. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at groundbreakingresearch.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Many of us take our human bodies for granted until something goes wrong, and then we start looking at our own carcass as something that needs to be fixed, or at least we need to get it to hurt less. But the human body is a thing of beauty and wonder that, considering it all, can be a jarring existential journey. Dr. Gabrielle Weston gives us a unique view on anatomy, drawn from her background as an English major and an award-winning writer, and now a notable surgeon. Her new book is Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence. And Dr. Weston, welcome to The Source.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
Well, reading your book is filled with a lot of graphic imagery. We can get into that as you write about the human body. You take us on a journey through it, discussing it in a philosophical kind of a view, but also a lot of literary references. And it reminded me of Mark Twain's Life on the Mississippi, where Twain reflects on how his perception of the Mississippi River changed after he became a steamboat pilot. At first, as a young man, he viewed the river as something, as a thing of beauty and mystery, you know, reflect the sunlight glistening on the water and the enchanting movements of the currents, the picturesque landscape. And then when he became a riverboat pilot, he began to see the river differently. It now became something that he had to navigate, and he would read the ripples in the water for submerged danger, noting the subtle shifts in color that indicated depths and interpreting how the current might affect navigation. And that seems like that's how you kind of view the body. We have to look at it in terms of a pragmatic view of how do we protect and maintain, sustain our bodies, but also it is a thing of beauty and mystery.
I mean, that's such a lovely association. Thank you so much, David. In a way, it happened the other way around for me.
Yes.
So I did a degree in English and philosophy before I went to medical school. And in fact, when I started training as a surgeon, I think I was very actively trying to subvert what I kind of considered to be the old-fashioned arty part of me, because I was so concerned if I let any of that aesthetic side of my character shine through that I sort of wouldn't pass as a proper surgeon or doctor. And it really wasn't until I was sort of established as a surgeon that I started to feel that subverting and hiding that side of me was really a waste. And that in a way was the start point for this book. I thought, wouldn't it be interesting, rather than trying to keep the artistic and scientific separate, if I saw what happened if I allowed them to sort of reflect off each other?
Looking at Twain's view as of the entire Western world, as we look at the human body, Twain used the transformation as a metaphor for knowledge and experience, that having a deeper understanding of the river came at a cost of losing that sense of wonder, which I think we see that in your book. As we move forward towards a more tightly constrained view of the body, we have given up, and you're trying to reclaim that without also giving up on understanding the science.
That's absolutely right. So I mean, listeners will be glad and reassured to hear that when I'm actually operating, this more arty part of my nature and the way I see things is something I kind of switch off. I actively sort of think of a switch and me turning it off. But so much of the time, when I have some spare time, I like to go and watch other people's operations or go into quite extreme medical and surgical scenes in order to really give free rein to this more artistic side of who I am. And in those moments, I just feel the same absolute thrill at the beauty of the human body, particularly the inside of it when I'm seeing that, as I did on my first day at medical school. And I think really what deepened this relationship for me during the writing of this book was that it became something much more than an intellectual exercise. My son was diagnosed with a brain tumor when I was in the middle of writing Alive. And I myself was diagnosed with a heart condition, which one day will require open heart surgery. And it was as if life was giving me these two sort of very profound opportunities to try and reconcile what it is that we as doctors feel we can know with this much, much more tricky and profound experience of actually living inside bodies ourselves, which of course are fragile for all of us, doctors included.
And what about us as a society when we lean heavily into the idea of our body as being as a virtually a mechanical device and stepping away from the wonder and also the mind-body? They talk about mind-body connection, but I like to think of it as the mind-body union.
I absolutely agree. I think connection is misleading, isn't it? And I understand why for all of us, for doctors, but also for human beings when we're patients, that there's something reassuring about this notion that our bodies work like machines. Certainly in my book, in the heart chapter, I kind of examined this notion that came about in the sort of 18th and 19th centuries that the heart was just a pump. And of course, we know better now. We know through the emergence of something called Takotsubo's cardiomyopathy, which is also known as broken heart syndrome, that when we have difficult emotions, they actually affect the way that our heart functions at a tissue level. That, of course, is true of the gut as well. We know that because of all this new exploding knowledge on the microbiome. But I think we like to think of our bodies as machines because machines are fixable. And there's something much more terrifying about this sense of the body being, you know, a kind of fragile organism that's very, very, well, like you say, not just connected to who we are, but it is who we are in an important sense.
But also you write about the heart as a pump. The idea of the heart being a pump didn't really take hold until we actually had mechanical pumps.
Yes, so absolutely that's right. That was, I was reading a fascinating essay by a man called Jonathan Miller, who isn't around anymore, but he was a theatre director who was an erstwhile doctor. And he came up with this fascinating idea that I'd never thought of before, that sometimes it's not just that we have our metaphors as sort of frills on top of the more prosaic rational truth of science. Sometimes actually, until we have a metaphor for something, we can't really articulate what the science of that thing is. And so Jonathan Miller argues in his essay on the heart that until we had pumps, you know, until pumps were invented, the heart was actually seen more as a sort of gaslight or, you know, something that glowed rather than something that pumped things around the body. And the reason I find that so fascinating is it chimes with my sense writing this book that the way we see ourselves and our bodies has got as much to do with storytelling as it does to do with anatomy.
Right. And objectifying, sexualizing, ignoring, we want to ignore the limit. You know, we talk about the brevity of existence in your book, how important that is. We have to, I guess, in order to appreciate the body, we have to recognize its fragility.
Absolutely, we do. And I think as doctors, that's something that for all sorts of reasons, we are really encouraged not to do. When a patient comes into the room, even now that we're trying to be more like guides rather than sort of patronizing know-alls on the other side of the desk, I still think there's a sense that as a doctor in a room when a patient enters, that you stand above them somehow. You're the person with the knowledge, and they are the body upon whom that knowledge is landing. And I really feel that if we could just, as doctors and as medics, get more in touch with the reality that our bodies are also fallible, that we are teaching, as it were, our patients from within the very self-same structures that they have and their vulnerability, we can perhaps start to bridge a gap, which I feel is a very kind of therapeutically hollow gap sometimes between the doctor and the patient. And that feels very important to me now, having been a patient myself, that I've come back to being a doctor with a new sense, I feel, of a kind of a way of connecting and bridging with my patients that I didn't have before.
We'll come back. We'll talk more about the book Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence with Dr. Gabriel Weston. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Stay with us.
Support for TPR comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp carrier dedicated to handling claims proactively and a commitment to helping injured employees and workers' comp policyholders get back to business. TexasMutual.com/claims.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a conversation with Dr. Gabriel Weston. She is a surgeon. She is on TV, a presenter, and she is also an author, a literary expert. Dr. Gabriel, thank you so much for joining us today. Her book is Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence. You mentioned the gut microbiome earlier, and I want to dig into the gut, how important that is. And you write about it in your book as we're really only now, maybe in the past 10, 20 years, really getting a better understanding about how important the gut bacteria and the viruses and the fungi and the yeast and all these things inside our gut, how they impact our bodies. Well, what can you tell us?
Yeah, so you're absolutely right, David. When I was at medical school about 30 years ago, we had this sort of false understanding that of all the parts of the gut, that the large intestine was the one where really not very much happened. So we thought the colon was essentially the place where water was removed and what was going to become feces was just sort of dried out and made solid. And as you say, in the last 10 to 20 years, there's been an absolute explosion in the research community and also now in the public, which has been telling us about the community of all the different microbes, the bacteria, the fungi, the yeasts that populate our gut, and a real sense for the first time that these things are actually doing something. We used to think of them as a kind of junk. You know, we knew that feces were made of food that wasn't going to be absorbed or used in any way, plus all of this stuff, but we didn't think there was a purpose to it. And I'm sure most of your listeners will be aware of this idea now of the gut-brain axis. And essentially what that is referring to is the discovery that all of the living microorganisms inside the gut are in constant communication with the rest of the body, in particular with the brain. So what we've discovered is that there's a reciprocal relationship between these things. And what that really means is, say, for example, you're feeling down, you're anxious or depressed, or something's happened in your life that means that the way you're thinking about the world has been changed. There's likely to be a parallel change in the microbiota, that, you know, the different organisms you have in your gut. Similarly, if you have a gut infection, or for whatever reason you develop diarrhea or inflammatory bowel disease, or something's not right with your gut, the alteration of the balance of those different microorganisms within your gut can also have an effect on the way you feel and the way you think. Now, this, honestly, had this been raised when I was a medical student, it would have sounded entirely unbelievable. And I think all of this amazing science about the gut microbiome, which is now attracting so many interesting ideas about how we can help people, is such a perfect example of how at any one point in time, we tend to believe that the knowledge base we're working from is the definitive knowledge base. And of course, as time goes by, we discover new things and new ways of looking. But the other thing that my book showed me was that it wasn't just that we discover new things. Sometimes we even find that things that were known about in the past, for one reason or another, have kind of dropped out of the canon of medical knowledge and almost need to be unearthed all over again.
So the gut microbiome, when you take antibiotics, as you write about in the book, the patients who have gut issues, they may have taken too much antibiotics and it may have killed out some of the beneficial microbiome.
Exactly.
So it needs to be recolonized.
That's absolutely right. So an example of that is a really nasty gut infection called C. diff, which is caused by a form of bacterium inside the gut. And many of us will have that bacterium in our guts and have no ill effects from it. But what happens is if a patient needs to take antibiotics for something else, and this is why it tends to happen to patients in hospital, there can be a sudden change in the balance of the microorganisms in the gut so that suddenly C. diff, having been one in a crowd, becomes like the bully in the crowd. And then in that context can start to wreak real havoc on the gut, to the extent that when it's very serious, patients can get a form of gut inflammation, which is actually life-threatening. And C. diff currently is killing about 25,000 people a year in the US. It's a real problem. It's a problem in hospitals all over the world. And there's increasing evidence, although actually there's been evidence from about the early 20th century, that this particular hospital-acquired infection is absolutely related to the way we doctors are treating patients with antibiotics.
You're saying we should eat about 30 different vegetables in a week in order to maintain a healthy, diverse microbiome in our gut. And it'll be a way to, as I understand, there's a scale, a Bristol scale of our quality of our feces, you know. So you're going for a Bristol 3, is that it?
It's absolutely amazing, isn't it, to think that, there's now a way of scoring yourself on the quality of your poo. But you're absolutely right that there's a lot of evidence to show that the more fiber you eat and the more different kinds of vegetables in particular, the more favorable that will be for your gut. Of course, for patients who get severe C. diff infections in their gut, not only do they not feel like eating, they're past the point where that would make a difference. And I'm sure your listeners, many of them will be aware of a thing that has been used to treat C. diff, which is a little different than what we used to do, which is just give more antibiotics, which is to do a fecal transplant, where essentially, rather than going for vegetables and the sort of difficult way of doing it, you just take feces from a healthy patient who has a good mix of microbiota in their poo, and you transplant that into the gut of someone who's suffering.
Right, it can be in capsule form or it can be going up the other end.
That's right.
So I hear that people are almost like experimenting on themselves in this area, and they're reporting that they have a brother or a cousin or a lover that they're going to use their poo for the, and then they report that they are also now gaining other personality traits that they got the donor from. And it shows you how the microbiome really does control so much more of us than we're willing to admit.
Absolutely. I mean, it's absolutely right. Of course, when it's these anecdotal fecal transplants that are being done between family members or friends, I mean, we have to have an element of sort of skepticism. That's not me writing off by any means, but, you know, these are anecdotal reports. But I certainly did hear from a woman who's right at the forefront of what's known as FMT, which is fecal microbiota transplant, who works in the States, that she started to notice that there were some of these, you know, were some of these similarities in the donor and the recipient. And in fact, she had a patient come to her one time whose C. diff had been completely cured by having FMT, but who for the first time in her life was reporting to this doctor that she had put on a lot of weight and she'd never struggled with her weight before. And when that doctor went back to look at the donor and who the donor was, the donor had had difficulties as well. So I think it's interesting, isn't it, that when fecal microbiota transplant was first being performed, it really was looking like one of those absolute miracle cures. And I think now, to a degree, we're kind of having to look back at that and appreciate maybe that a little bit more care and studying needs to take place, not least because there have been a couple of episodes where some cross-infection has taken place and things have not done so well.
Well, what about this new idea that there is actually a microbiome in our brain?
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of just coming out, isn't it? And I feel in this area that it sort of feels like the sky's the limit with this stuff. I mean, if you were to draw a graph of the explosion in research and discovery in the area of the gut microbiome, it kind of plateaued until about 10, 20 years ago. And now it's just almost every day there's more stuff coming out. So I think it's a case of sort of watch this space with the brain.
And they call, you know, a gut instinct. It's almost like a second brain that we have within the micro, in the gut, telling us some things that almost like instinct.
Exactly. I mean, there's lots of neurons in the gut. And yeah, I think there's a lot of science. I mean, and it goes back in a way, doesn't it, to my, I mean, I don't want to call it a message, but I guess if there's anything in this book that is the one way that I would sum it up, it is about connection, you know, connection between body and mind, connection between patient and doctor, connection between our strong selves and our vulnerable selves. So I mean, I love to hear whenever the body is declaring this truth in a different department of itself, because it just seems more and more and more that we're finding out that this kind of essential message is true.
And do you think that the overconsumption of hyperprocessed foods like we have here in the United States, is that one of the challenges that we have for a healthy microbiome in the gut? Because they're not getting vegetables, they're not actually digesting anything, because in a hyperprocessed food, the food doesn't even have to be digested sometimes.
I think there's absolutely no doubt that the message about hyper and ultra processed food is probably one of the most important health messages of the last 10 years. And certainly, as someone, I've never dieted myself. I, you know, come from a family of kind of neurotic thin people, but I've got a lot of friends who have been on diets over the years, and you know, I always feel a little downhearted when I see the next diet book on their bedside table. But I really do think the message of, you know, if we could just try harder to not eat processed stuff, I think that it's just a good basic message.
Well, you can thank your own gut microbiome for your physical shape, I guess. We're going to take a break here. It's 1 minute break. The Source continues right after this. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about the new book, Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence. We're joined by the author, Dr. Gabriel Weston. Not only is the human body fantastic is that it's able to sustain us and keep us going and running marathons and doing all sorts of incredible things, but it's also, for at least half of us, it's able to produce another human body. And it does seem like, though, medical science has been challenged often in trying to explain that in a way that that men can process. That's the problem with it. So Dr. Gabriel Weston, you write in the book that there have been medical books that just completely skipped over parts of the female anatomy because I guess men were too freaked out by it.
Yeah. I mean, each one of the chapters in my book is focusing on a different area of the body. And when it came to our genitals, initially I thought, well, I better have one chapter for the female genitalia and one chapter for the male genitalia. And then when I came to do a bit of research, the thing that struck me so joyfully was that from an anatomical point of view, the male and female genitalia are actually remarkably similar. So you're absolutely right. There have been studies done in the UK, really scary studies that say things like less than 50% of the population are able to label the basic parts of the female vulva, for example. So I definitely felt this was an area where some more information needed to be put out there. But the further I delved into male and female genitalia from a research point of view, the more I realized that every single nerve, blood vessel, muscle, and tissue that you see between a man's legs also is replicated between a woman's legs. And to begin with, I thought, that doesn't make sense, because surely the opposite of the penis is the vagina, and they're not similar at all. But actually, in a kind of light bulb moment, when I was doing my research with all my anatomy books out in front of me, I realized that the explanation for this anomaly is that actually the opposite of the penis is not the vagina. The vagina is just a space. The opposite of the penis is actually the clitoris. So in this chapter, which I have to say, I absolutely loved writing, I'm trying to...
It did seem like you were working through something in this chapter. But you write here, if we girls and women are led to believe our genitals are a blank, what hope do we have?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I am really a feminist, and there's nothing lovelier than when you find that something as supposedly neutral as anatomy is kind of championing your cause. And yeah, so this discovery that I had when I was looking at the anatomy, that if you look at any single part of the anatomy of the penis, you can find its replica. It's just that the clitoris is mainly buried. So we only see the tip of it. That's the only bit that we're aware of. But actually, if you look into the female pelvis, you can find all the parts of the anatomy that are hanging out more externally and more flamboyantly in the male. You can find those in the female too. And obviously, we're living in a time where there's a great deal of sensitivity and controversy around ideas of sex and gender. And in a way, what I thought would be a kind of beautiful experience for this chapter would be to just take a step back from all of that stuff, to not make any proclamations about that stuff, but to simply look at what scans and specimens and books and anatomy could tell me. And in a way, if anatomy can give you a message, the message in this department was, we're all really similar. I mean, I know we men and women, we go out into the world and we feel that we're incredibly different, but at a very basic reproductive level, we're all very, very similar.
Well, I do want to focus on a critical difference that you bring up in the book, and it's how men and women are treated during having a cardiac arrest. And that women whose heart stopped are more likely to die than men in the same situation. That, why is that?
Yeah. So thank you. This was a really important study that came out in the Netherlands recently, where the researcher focused on a particular town in the Netherlands and basically was assessing what happens to people if they have symptoms of a cardiac arrest in public, and then what happens to those patients once they reach hospital and onwards. And the conclusions of this study were that at every stage of the process, women are ignored with important heart symptoms and men are not. And so, for example, if a woman is having a cardiac arrest or is having a heart attack, let's say, which is one cause of a cardiac arrest out in public, the way that she experiences those symptoms is not the way we're taught about them at medical school. So at medical school, we're taught if someone has central crushing chest pain and they start to clutch their left arm or their jaw and they become pale and sweaty, that's a heart attack. Now, often in women, the symptoms present differently. People sometimes have softer symptoms than that. They might not be clutching their chest. They might feel sick rather than have this central crushing chest pain. They might actually have the same symptoms, but because they're women, they're not worrying about them being a heart attack, so they don't draw them to someone's attention. So there's that first thing there. Which
so we
is
have to raise that awareness. That
we have to raise that awareness. And then even this study then continued to look at patients once they were in the hospital. And even when it looked as if the medics were aware that a cardiac arrest had taken place, the women were slower to be investigated.
So I'm really short on time here, but I want to make a point. This is why diversity, equity, and inclusion and accessibility is so important in medical science. We need to have different views, different voices in our medical world to save lives. Dr. Gabriel Weston, thank you so much. The new book is Alive, Our Bodies and the Richness and Brevity of Existence. Great for having you on here. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.